The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am Miriam Spector, and I am proud to be the Vice Chair of the Board of the Foundation of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Currently a Columbia University professor of art history and history, Professor Sharma has previously taught at Cambridge, Oxford, and Harvard. His award-winning books have been translated into 15 languages. He has been an essayist and critic for The New Yorker for over 20 years, for which he has won the National Magazine Award for Criticism. Professor Sharma has also written and presented more than 40 documentaries on art, literature, and history for the BBC, PBS, and the History Channel. His five-part BBC and PBS documentary series, The Story of the Jews with Simon Sharma, covers 3,000 years of Jewish history. He has appeared here at the library previously to talk about his books, Scribble, 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 The American Future, and his first installment of The History of the Jews. In his second written installment of The Story of the Jews that he will speak to us about tonight, he details the Jewish experience in all corners of the world, from the Galilee to the Ukraine to California, through the end of the 19th century. He will be signing his books in the library at the end of his presentation. His talk tonight will be in conversation with Carlin Romano, critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, former literary critic at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and author of The American Philosophical. Please join me in welcoming Simon Sharma and Carlin Romano back to the Free Library.
So I thought we would start out by talking a bit about you and your career, as opposed to just the book. Because I've been reading his Twitter account. Anybody read his Twitter account? It's wonderful. It's very funny, very up to the minute.
Viewer guidance advised.
Yeah. I don't think Trump.
How's your blood pressure, everybody?
Yeah.
If it's difficult, keep away from my Twitter account.
On his Twitter account, he identifies himself as historian, writer, art critic, cook, BBC presenter, but not necessarily in that order. So my question to begin is there an order, or are you just a jumble?
No, cook comes first.
Cook comes first,
yeah.
All right.
You know, all of Jewish history, famously, you all know this, is summed up as they tried to kill us, they failed, now let's eat. It's like also the ultimate Jewish joke, all best Jewish jokes, you know, involve food and mother, and sometimes at the same time. The ultimate Jewish joke, because it's the shortest as well, it's a waiter who comes up to ladies who've been of a certain age, who've been eating the same thing at the same place, the same time, for a long time, and the waiter leans over and all he says, "Is anything all right?" True of the world, really. That's a philosophical statement.
How many jokes are there in these first two volumes?
Not enough. But there is, you can find, I'm ashamed to say this will give it away and probably destroy what's left of my reputation. Mm-hmm. If you go to YouTube and you hit Simon Sharma Tells Jewish Jokes, you can see me doing stand-up in Chicago. It's true. To an audience of exacting Jews about many years ago. My friend Lawrence Weschler, who was a colleague of mine in The New Yorker, was then running the Chicago Festival of the Humanities. Mm-hmm. You've been there, Colin, I'm sure. And there was a theme every year, and one year it was comedy. And he phoned me up and said, "Well, you know more Jewish jokes, and, you know, come and talk about Jewish humor." And I said, "Sure, okay, fine, that'd be good." And then I thought, you know, almost as soon as I said yes, there is nothing less funny than a professor talking about humor. I mean, if you read Freud's jokes and their relation to the not funny. One is about kind of half joke, which is too terrible to tell you. So I thought, I don't want to lecture about Jewish humor, but I, you know, maybe. So I phoned him up without even saying who I was, just to try out, because I thought, yeah, and this could turn out to be a catastrophe. So I said, well, you know, there was, of course, a priest, a pastor, and a rabbi, and they needed to find out, you know, which was the ultimately superior religion. And obviously the way you do that, if you happen to be in the neighborhood of the Adirondacks, was to try and convert a bear. And so they all go off, they say, well, let's see how we do, and we'll come back at 4 o'clock and compare. Results, so they do, and the priest and the pastor, the priest says, well, how did you get on? To the pastor said, it was wonderful. It was a hot day, and the bear was hard, and I dipped him in the river, and he belongs to Jesus. And the priest said, well, my bear was hungry, and God had provided me with, you know, the communion wafer with the host, and now he belongs to St. Peter. And that moment, you know, the rabbi comes stumbling bloodily through the undergrowth and says, "Oi, boys, on second thought, circumcision was not the way to go." This is going well.
I think we should change the format right here. I think, and I have a feeling this is possible. Yeah. I think every one of us in this room should tell a Jewish joke. And then we'll see what time it is. Here's, I'm going to just throw a fast one back at you at Columbia. When I was a Columbia law student, the dean came out, and the parents were there for the annual show. And the dean said, "Welcome to Columbia, where all the great religions of the world are represented. Reform, conservative, orthodox."
That's very good.
No. All right, that's my Columbia good. Joke. All right, well, I'm going to shift you,
If you must.
Your book is wonderful for the same reason. Your humor is wonderful. It's lively. It's about the excitement of Jewish life, not just the tragedy of Jewish life. But it's a very long project. I heard that the third volume is going to begin with the Ethiopian Jews.
It does.
Is that true?
It begins with one extraordinary guy who's a carrier called Filkovich. Mm-hmm. And my inclination is not, the whole project, as you know, Colin, was sort of right about vitality rather than mortality. You can't pretend that the Death Star of the Shoah isn't kind of orbiting Jewish history. But as I was saying earlier on, particularly among non-Jews, what Jewish history means is either the Holocaust or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the whole of, you know, the vast span of Jewish history, the inevitability of ultimate calamity, while, you know, bad things could, we had to be prepared for bad things constantly around the corner. If you take it kind of place by place and time by time, this kind of inevitability of misery was not necessarily there. And even if it was, what is extraordinary about the story of the Jews is its urge to, as I say, vitality to life. There's that famous moment in the Torah where, you know, Moses reports God's as saying, "I've set before you as a blessing and a curse, life and death, therefore choose life." And, you know, the kind of motto of the whole project really was a kind of choose life project.
You know, I remember in Tel Aviv in Ben Gurion's house, there is an interview up on the wall, and the interviewer asked Ben Gurion, "Could you summarize Jewish history very briefly?" And his answer was, "Quality over quantity."
Yeah.
Seriously, that was his answer. But ethnocentric for some, perhaps, but I mean, very sharp and succinct.
Yeah.
Can you summarize Jewish history?
Well, I wouldn't summarize it that way. I know what Ben-Gurion meant, but actually, while you would never really want to say, put it the other way around, I think a lot of what I wanted to do, particularly in this volume, is really about abundance and variety. We were talking about this at dinner. And One, it doesn't really begin in 1492. This is a kind of, you know, publisher's requirement that there be some charismatic date. The first volume ends with the terrible, traumatic uprooting, expulsion of Jews from Spain. The book actually begins around 1520 for reasons that would be a spoiler to give away, but with an exciting moment. But what does happen at the beginning of the book in a more generic way is the printing press. And with the printing press comes the possibility of a life of words, and indeed actually of images, Jewish painting actually, which is not banned at all, occurs really very early on in the first chapter. But what happens is an enormous possible flowering of Jewish life beyond the Talmud, which isn't to say the Talmud isn't very important. It's not to say that, you know, the great codification of Jewish, the greatest codification of Jewish observance after Maimonides many centuries before is Joseph Caro's The Setting of the Table, Shulchan Aruch, which any observant Jews will know from growing up with. But so that is a kind of steady line. But what happens both inside the religion is a flowering beyond Talmudic, I won't say Talmudic narrow discourse, the Talmud is never narrow, but beyond the agenda set by Talmudic interpretation and commentary on the Mishnah and on the Bible. In other words, inside religion, Kabbalah happens in a huge way. Kabbalah is much older, but when it hits the possibility of being printed, all those weird and wacky numerological trees and, you know, signs and the extraordinary kind of myth, you know, not, I mean, the kind of the great fantastical tale of the way the cosmos is produced from Tzimtzum, from the withdrawal of God into a kind of black hole-like void. You know, I mean, it's this all becomes visible. Now, outside strict religion, very quickly in the 16th century, in so many languages, for a start, we have vernacular Jewish, we have local Jewish works of literature, where in Portuguese, in Judeo-Spanish, Ladino, in Italian, in many different kinds of Italian, in Demotic Greek, in German, the great woodcut presses of illustrated Haggadot in Prague. So we have the possibility of a multitudinous world of Jews. I mean, I once describe, you know, sometimes putting my just feeling, you know, with all these voices coming at me, it was like the biggest, shoutiest bar mitzvah kiddush there'd ever been, really. Mm-hmm. But that's really a wonderful thing, too. So really in the first, as you know, in the first kind of 100 pages or so, we meet the first Jewish actor manager in Mantua, 16th century Mantua, who published his memoirs and the first great book ever in any language on stagecraft, on makeup, on costume, on body language, and who writes both Hebrew comedies and who writes Italian grand, sort of like opera seria, sort of rather solemn, semi-mythical plays for the court. We have an escapologist called Abraham Coloni, who is also an inventor of weapons, extraordinarily bizarre weapons, including musical instruments that were turned into guns when you turn them a certain way. So we have an astonishing variety of possibilities of Jewish life, really.
Yeah, I was actually wondering in reading this, I thought there are 150 biographies in here that could be done.
Yes.
The fellow who ends up with Monticello and so on.
Yes.
You know, who knew about him?
Yes, the first Jewish high officer of the Navy in the 19th century, Yoriel Levy, who ends up owning, there's a wonderful scene where I start that chapter where it just seemed to be extraordinary that as he is then, Captain Levy and his mother, who'd been a great beauty in Philadelphia, indeed, and his slightly kind of lame and disabled, so two heavily black silk-clad Jewish matrons and the Jewish, you know, shortly to be Commodore, are standing in front of Monticello with the keys to the house. Their house.
Right.
Amazing.
So you know, the surprise when you see a book as large as this book is that it's not doctrinal, you know, like the Oxford history of very conscious on your part to make it stories about people,
Yes, I did. This started with volume one, so that the whole series is called Story, and it may be a little too cutely self-conscious, but Judaism begins as there are two things going on approximately at the same time between the 8th and the 7th century BC. The great, the great extraordinary bardic archaic poetry of the Greeks, the Homeric masterpieces and Hesiod are written, and at almost exactly the same time the Hebrew scripture is written, the Hebrew Bible, those extraordinary stories. And what's remarkable about both, really, is that while there is an astonishingly big mythical element of, divine intervention here, and in a Jewish case, a set of very definite ethics, which is only very inadvertently intrudes into the Homeric, great masterpieces. Essentially, what's extraordinary is that human beings with warts and all, think about Jonah, for example, or King David. These are real astonishing literary creations. So to me, Judaism really, this extraordinary possibility of actually building a religion out of a set of stories rather than theological propositions, was very much on my mind, actually. So the sense in which we are the world's ultimate storytellers,
Can you explain a little bit your Jewish background, your parents, and what your Jewish consciousness was growing up? I've read Scribble, 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 which is a wonderful book, by the way. There's a short pieces of Simon's. They're so funny. After you read the history of the Jews, go back and read Scribble, 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 because even in your short pieces, the drollery is just wonderful. But I remember when we had a conversation here with Bernard Henri Lévy, who had a book about Judaism recently, talking to him and asking, has this always been with you? I said, oh yeah, even before Levinas. I mean, every day I think about being Jewish.
Yeah, no, me too.
And yet you're identified with so many other things also.
Right. Talk about, right, as is he. But I don't know where to start. I mean, I grew up in an Orthodox home, not ultra-Orthodox, but Orthodox. Let's say we kept kosher, which I no longer do. I went to cheder at least three times a week. I taught in Hebrew school. I taught really chumash. I didn't really want to teach the prayer liturgy side of it, but I did love teaching the Bible. And so that was, we didn't drive cars or shop or anything on Shabbat. Did we turn on lights? Yeah, I think we did. So, some way there was a very, very strong sense. And also is born the other thing, without having said that one's whole life as Jew is absolutely not dominated by the Holocaust, it was there, all right. I mean, I remember one of my earliest experiences when we lived in a small town on the Thames estuary, however, two synagogues, as usual, one you went to, one you wouldn't be seen dead in, famous change. So I started to learn Hebrew when I was four. I know Mrs. Anne Marks, who was beautiful beyond the imaginings of a four-year-old child or a 40-year-old grown-up child. I was actually, I think at the age of six, I was dressed, to my mortification, this is one of my earliest memories, as Mr. Shabbat, which since there was a kind of, bridal Mrs. Shabbat, who had a kind of little mini white dress, and I was mortified because I had to wear a very small top hat, a very small high hat, and which kept falling off. I was saved by my outsized elephantine protruding ears from the hat really going. So that whole Jewish world, we then moved into London when I was about 9 years old, and it flooded my life in many ways. But very interestingly, when one thinks about, you know, the tough times that we're going through in some ways, both in Israel and outside of it, that for my father, being British and Jewish was completely unproblematic for him. He had been, like a lot of Jews in his generation, he was a street corner orator, by which I meant he would take on the black shirt fascists. He'd be beaten up a lot, and he would get up and do it all over again. Like, as I can say, like a lot of his generation and young Jews growing up in the East End of London, he was at that famous moment where the black shirts, the fascist organization, tried to march through the Cable Street, through the heart of London's Jewish area, and there were bad fights and so on. But my father's essential. He insisted that I learn how to debate when I was really quite young. And he said the Jew's only real weapon is his mouth. And he would stand at the back of the room. I was in many debating teams up and down the country. And he would simply, and I have to lean back, he would go, "Louder, Simon, louder." And that's so, I don't really need to be any louder, you know. My father also his other thing, which is very rooted, having talked about the great Leonie Di Somi in Mantua, the great showman. My father really wanted to go into that. When I said, well, maybe backtrack just a little bit. When I say it was unproblematic, so we would have all this Shabbat, Sabbath, Jewish life, but on Sunday, an absolute ritual, almost theological rituals. My father would always read Dickens at tea time, out loud, doing all the parts, every single Sunday. And my sister was a lot older, but it was all thrilling for us, really, and scary. You know, he was a hell of a magwitch. And my father had wanted to go into the theatre. His father said, if you do that, don't ever bother coming home again. So, yeah, my grandfather, obviously a horrible man. He died before I was born, so I didn't know how horrible he was, but that did kind of blight my father's life. He was not a particularly good businessman. He hated being in the family textile business. We were sporadically very well off and then broke, and then well off and then broke. I mean, we were, you know, self-inflicted suitcase people, really. But he was obsessed with the theatre and with literature generally. Really, he took me to my first Shakespeare play, which was Richard Burton as Henry V at the at the Old Vic Theatre. I think for my 9th birthday, and I sat in the 4th row. And, you know, London, so it was 1954, 55. London was still beaten up. There was still soot. There were kind of bombed out buildings sticking out black and charred like rotting teeth, and it was a kind of dark city. So you went into this theatre, and I remember it was John Neville, who was a great actor, now really forgotten. I remember sitting in the darkness, and I thought I could smell the glow. What I was smelling was a rather dingy props and costume department. But I remember John Neville came in, and there was an immense throw of a red cape, which I think actually Olivier pinched for his Henry V, or the other way around. But it was this huge, enormous outside cape, and it began with Neville's, you know, the opening of that. And it's an extraordinary opening to a Shakespeare play, because it's the only one, really. It was, I think, the first. My wonderful colleague Jim Shapiro, in his great 1599 book, will let you know for sure. But I'm pretty sure it was the first one play to be produced at the Globe, when they moved to the Globe, and the other side of the river, so they were freer. And it's addressed specifically to the audience. That great opening chorus is about the imagination of the mind and sight. So, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the very heaven of invention, my kingdom for a stage, etc., etc. And I was, my little heart was going pitter-pat. And but my father laid down a condition before I would get that incredible treat. Renée Acheson as Catherine. I remember everything about that play and that night. And I had to learn, and I was nine, the whole of Henry V's speech before the gates of Harfleur, which I can still do, but only in a nine-year-old voice. Once more, onto the bridge, dear friends. Once more, we'll fill the walls up with our English dead. My father directing this time, not so loud. In peace. There nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But we're in the blast of war. Anyway, I did this a lot in the living room. And then I did it at our kind of elementary school concert. I remember looking out into the audience at my father and mother. My father was, you know, for once resisting the urge to direct me. And my father, I could just see, like Cheshire Cat, a smile with a big Jewish face attached. Meanwhile, my mother was kind of beetroot red with butter-clenching embarrassment, really. Actually horrified at this kind of freak little actor she'd produced. But we had, you know, but she shouldn't have been embarrassed, because actually a standard breakfast at least once or twice a week in the Sharma household, this is true, everybody, would consist, and I will not do the performance for you, I'll be grateful for this, was where were I'm kind of eating my, you know, my kind of Rice Krispies or something, you know, in the horrible London fog, as it was in the 1950s, was sort of outside, and it was cold and miserable, and I didn't really want to go to school. And my father would kind of, and my sister and I would be at this table in this very modest kitchen, and a door would be flung open. There were two doors, one on the left, one on the right. And my father would come through, and he would be singing something from Irving Berlin, or the worst was "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" from Oklahoma, you know. And then my mother would come in from the other side. So my father would start, "There's no business." And my mother would come in, "Like show business." And I thought, I just want to eat my cornflakes, you know, and so get out of here. So this was my life as a child. Just basic, ordinary life, really, you know.
Do you think he has an autobiography in him? You haven't written an autobiography.
Because you'd have to leave out all the sex.
Right. Oh,
which is, you know, because you'd embarrass your children so badly with that, and they're the fun bits.
Well, I want to come back to your family from this standpoint. One of the things I like about your book and your approach to Jewish history is that it's not just European.
Right.
Jewry.
Right.
And if I understand correctly, maybe I'm wrong, your father came from Sephardic lineage and your mother from Ashkenazi.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. No, we used to call ourselves Sephardic.
So that's that in itself, right, gave you a dimension.
That's
and you write
right.
about China. I mean,
I do.
If any of you go to Shanghai, you can see the Shanghai Jewish community and the museum there. Quite a fascinating story.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel like you've always had this ecumenical approach
Absolutely.
To Jewish life?
Again, I think when we moved back to London in the kind of mid to late 1950s, I knew somehow that in this rather grey, tweedy, slightly moth-eaten world of Britain at that time, apart from the romance of history and of Shakespeare, my little corner of it in northwest London, it was full of Italians, and I met my first Asian friends, meaning India from Indian origins. And I knew how extraordinary, you know, how special that really was. So London was not like the London now. So there was, and also my mother, which, you know, there were fantastical stories, but most of them, astonishingly, as the years went on, you know, turned out to be true. My mother's family, which came from Lithuania, however, was really far flung. And I was saying at dinner that we were the Steinbergs, that the family were in the timber trade, which meant actually we were kind of lumberjacks and river loggers. That was a very extremely common occupation for Jews. You know, it wasn't all like Fiddler on the Roof with, you know, one goat and two cows, or two goats and one cow. There were a very wide variety of occupations patients you were in, and the two most dominant ones were actually keeping an inn and distilling and brewing, being a pub keeper basically, or actually being in the timber trade in some way, and usually in that rather menial, slightly physically dangerous, interesting way that the Steinbergs were in. So, but my mother said we had a great aunt Jean whose family had settled in Harbin in Manchuria in the 1870s. Okay. We had a family in Valparaiso in Chile. Yeah, well, we, the Sharmas, initially, it was said, impossible to prove, came from Aleppo. We were not the kind of superior Sephardim. Sephard, of course, means Spain. So the grandees were called Rodriguez and Martinez and Pinto and so on. They were far out of our league. We were what would be called Mizrahi Jews in Israel now. So we were, you know, we emerged from some point in the Oriental, genuinely Levantine Oriental world. And some of the Sharmas went, the successful ones, went to Livorno in Italy and spelled their name S-C-I-A. And we ended up, not unsuccessful, trading spices, particularly cinnamon, another very common Jewish occupation in the Ottoman Turkish world in Izmir. But we had a family joke in the Sharmas, and you all have been warned, where Sharmas go, empires fall. Because we went from Ottoman Turkey, briefly in a Habsburg Empire, to Britain, and here I am, everyone. So,
Now I'm understanding the darkness of your Twitter feed.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Better ship me to Shanghai, you know.
If you want to read, you know, some of the funniest running commentary on the age of Trump, please read his Twitter about, you know, President Bonespur and things like
yes.
that. Yes.
You know. Well, you have to laugh lest you cry your eyes out, really.
No. Yes. You, in this book, I love Scribble, Scribble, Scribble. You start out by saying that you have two writing styles, anal and loopy. Now. Yeah. You're talking
about the worst cartoon ever made,
yes.
you know.
Anal and loopy.
Yeah. Anal loopy tunes,
right.
Yeah.
So you're talking about calligraphy there, but I wonder if it doesn't apply a little bit to... You know,
probably does.
The warp and woof of your work?
No, I think I'm through my anal epoch, yeah. actually, right. Carlin, if ever I had one. Right. The story behind that was my professor at Cambridge, who I love very much, and who was really, I mean, part of the reason that... many historians who are my friends, and nearly all younger than me, actually, but I think Neil Ferguson and David Cannodine in Britain, they all came through the hands of J.H. Plum, who was very well known in America in the 60s and who wrote for Horizon magazine and a lot for the New York Review of Books. And Jack, as we called him, was someone who believed that history was a kind of public craft, you know, which fits very well with the, you know, the requirement in Judaism to zachor, to remember, you know, really. And that I remember Jack paraphrasing what was in turn a paraphrase by E.M. Forster of a famous saying by Kipling, still with me. And what Forster said when paraphrasing Kipling, Kipling said, what do they know of England who only England know? And Forster switched that to, what do they know of history who only other historians know? And that was really Jack's motto, that he used to say, well, remember, Simon, you belong to an ancient craft which began with Herodotus shouting in the marketplace. And we actually know that Herodotus sometimes, now we know, sang, actually, his history, which makes sense at Delphi, apart from other places as well. And the sort of sense in which history is not a kind of ivory tower profession, that, of course, scholarship is absolutely always the bedrock of its truth and its research. But Plum's view was that hardcore academic scholarship and the public voice nourished each other, and that if you were just inside the academy, you were really, in some sense, almost, I mean, I won't say betraying, but compromising what history was supposed to do. But if you're only a popular historian, you know, dealing in generalizations that weren't embedded in archival knowledge, then you were, you know, you were lightweight. So that was a great sort of accidental gift I got, really, I think.
And you ran with that, for sure.
Yeah, I run with it all my life, and I try, and I remember Plum used to read our essays out to him in Cambridge, and he would spend a quarter of an hour dissecting a single paragraph, simply stylistically. So his other message was that if you're going to be read by people beyond the academy, the writing itself was not just simply a mechanical medium. it was the indispensable art. Mm-hmm. It was the voice, really. And I try and teach my own students that as well. You know, it is very.
I'm glad I'm going to open it up to questions in a moment. But I did, while we're in this area of history, I wanted to toss back at you something from your Twitter feed because it seems that every once in a while you do utter a kind of oracular view about history. This is what you had recently, and this was about what's been going on in our government. The absolute worst thing a general or secretary of defense can do is to read about the last war and imagine its preparation for the next. And I was thinking, gee, that's like the opposite of Santayana, right? The famous Santayana line. Should a historian, I mean, you've written wonderfully and accessibly about history, as you're doing now about Jewish history, but is it a part of the historian's role to kind of have large generalizations about history and life, or just tell the stories?
Well, Thucydides thought so, and who am I to disagree? Thucydides, of course, was a general who was fired. In the Peloponnesian War, kind of had an axe to grind, never finished the masterpiece, finished by Xenophon, but it was, for him, really, what was at stake, the two things, the integrity, I mean, he and Herodotus together, but particularly Honor to Thucydides, who has a much more, you know, steely style, I suppose you would say, than Herodotus. Herodotus is a great Ionian. You know, he's not from Athens. So he's fantastically, you know, he's saturated in the world of many cultures at that end of the Mediterranean. So he takes very seriously wanting to know, we would call it pretentiously, the ethnography of the enemy. He wants to know all about the Persians, and then he can't help himself. He has to know all about the Egyptians, and mythology and fantasy and that sort of thing is all mixed up. So by the time he delivers you the Persian army, you know, you feel you know an awful lot about what made them be as they were. Thucydides is much more laser targeted to fundamental principles, not just of what is a democracy, what is a truly moral politics, and how it can come unglued in an epidemic, for example. You know, it's a great, literally in every way, classic description of the collapse of a civil society under the assault of a pandemic is a few pages of plague in Athens. But the other crucial thing, apart from the sense that you had a public civic vocation, and I don't think, I would guess that even Thucydides thought it was perfectly okay to be a chronicler, you know, and that other societies, no doubt in Mesopotamia, just needed lists of kings and their triumphs. But the essential honor of being an historian that Thucydides coined and passed down was the obligation to be a disturber of the powerful, that including yourself. All the kids, if they still read Thucydides, which I really hope they do at college in core curriculum, they always get to read the famous speech by Pericles, which kind of half made up about what are the principles for which it's worth laying down your life. But actually, Thucydides was a great dramaturge, and the whole structure of the book, in its many aspects, is built around this catastrophic climax of the failed expedition to Sicily, to Syracuse. So it's the ultimate example of an Athenian looking bleakly and with utterly icy clarity about the catastrophe that will befall the overconfident. Are you listening, Trumpolini?
Trumpolini,
yeah.
Another fine name for our leader.
Now, do you suppose if we all tell him to read Thucydides' his will? Right. Probably not. You know, I like to think that one day he'll be caught in the deepest sand trap in the world out at Bedminster, and everybody will have gone and he can't get out, and we can throw him Thucydides in there, really. You know, probably won't happen. But the honour really is to be, in that sense, if not, you know, permanently oppositional, is to be a pain in the neck, is to be a gadfly, is to really not history. Can very easily, this is what happens in totalitarian regimes, which we are not yet. History can be an exercise in self-congratulation. It can, whether it's you know, what became of history, such as it was in Soviet Russia, or, you know, wherever it's going to be. It can just be about, it's the genealogy of the wonderfulness of us, our regime. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you think your job, it's perfectly fine for history to be a stroll down memory lane. I wasn't the greatest fan of Downton Abbey, which I seem to remember. I described as, what did I describe, do you remember, Carly, but something like, I don't know. I wasn't all that. Occasionally I liked it, mostly I didn't. But it's fine, it's fine. It was, you know, history can be romantic. I know what I called it, yeah, a sustained exercise in cultural necrophilia. That didn't... Maggie Smith was not pleased with that description, actually. It didn't win me friends. But, you know, that's perfectly fine. But if you want to really, you know, the energetic pulse of history is self-critical, really. That's its contribution to freedom.
And I will just put in a plug for one of your books. One of the things I love about great historians is they usually uncork at least one book about history. His book, Dead Certainties, way back, about what's possible and not possible in history, is really a superb book.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's open it up to questions. We have two folks here with microphones, right? Who'd like to start? Right in the middle there. Yeah.
In your researches, have you found some things in the Jewish experience that you can point to that maybe lead to the excellence as humorists that have been discussed today?
Wouldn't it be good if you could? I mean, it's... the real answer is no, but the very tantalizing reason is that... the deep question... is why, and maybe when you're kind of on the hoof all the time, you know, your life is a kind of touring company or something like that. So that's all, you know, facetious response almost, or not very well thought through. But what I was going to say to you is that, astonishingly, I did find in the research that, a little bit was known, but not the jokes, alas, that Jews were hired to be basically comedians at the weddings of Polish Catholic aristocrats, and they were called Badchanim, and they were kind of Jewish jesters, basically. The great Czartoryskis and Radziwills and all the rest of them had their own kind of 18th century, slightly over bewigged and dainty, you know, official funny people. But actually, the sort of sense of anything going seems to have been why they were essentially, Badchanim were hired at these non-Jewish occasions. They also were hired at big Jewish weddings, but they were hired in non-Jewish celebrations to roast the bride and groom and their parents. And always got off scot-free. I did find a reference, amazingly, in the Renaissance, I think through the Cecil Roth's wonderful book about Jews in Renaissance Italy, that there was actually two obviously clowns, they were called, but they're obviously comedians, called Solly and Jacob, were hired for a very grand ducal wedding at Mantua again. But what we do know, and this is as close as I can get, again, to slightly enriched description for your article, one of the places where Jews and non-Jews came into contact, especially in Italy, but not only in Italy, and especially in Venice, were during the time of the Purim Spiels. Purim plays. Purim is a, you know, great chaotic celebration of the deliverance of Jews from the evil conspiracy of Haman. And it was really almost like a kind of carnival. They were called kind of lords of misrule. I mean, the Purim Spiel scripts were written. A Polish one survives from the 16th century. And they're very, very elaborate. They went way beyond the story of Esther and Mordecai and Haman. And lines were given to the dopey guards and so on. And it looks to me, and certainly loads of the patricians, they all flocked into the ghetto to see the Purim Spiel. And the same is true in many of the other, even the horrible ghetto at Rome was the one time when there was a real kind of mixing. So the sense in which, you know, you for once you left behind totally your sense of contempt for the Jews, really. It was when you were in their world of what you kind of, I guess, call proto-showbiz, really. And that starts amazingly early. In volume one, I discovered that part of the reason the horrible John Chrysostom was so violently determined to demonize Jews, renowned 4th century AD Antioch in Syria, was that those rabbis delivering sermons to Rashot, commentaries on the Bible, were so eloquent that actually people who had been converted to Christianity in Antioch used to go and hear the Jewish sermons without any expectation of being. And that absolutely, of course, was absolutely an outlandish and dangerous thing to do. And fast forward again to the period I was just talking about, 16th century Italy, when they all came to hear Purim plays, when the Counter-Reformation kicks off brutally in the middle of the 16th century, one of its obsessions is physically separating Jews and non-Jews. And you could only do this up to a point. The ghetto was open in Venice during the day. It was horribly locked and patrolled at night. And again, very interestingly, at night, only two classes of Jew were allowed to leave the ghetto: doctors and dancing teachers.
Well, you tell people a lot of things that they didn't know before. I wonder how often you tell people things that they thought they knew, which isn't true, and in Jewish history and other areas, and how much resistance you have to meet when you're debunking or challenging what are dearly held or long-held ideas in history.
Fake news and Jewish history.
Yeah.
Your next volume. No.
Do you know, there are historians, some really brilliant ones, who are, you know, have the kind of adrenaline rush of revisionism. I don't even want to use that word because it sounds like I'm talking about Holocaust now, and I'm not, but who really love the overthrow of long accepted. I've never actually been interested in that. I mean, when I wrote the book on the French Revolution, I remember, because I was giving lectures of the French Revolution, but I was mostly working on Dutch history, this is in the 1980s, and my publisher then in Penguin said, you know, I hear a lot about your lectures, you know, your first book was somewhat about the French Revolution, the bicentennial's coming up. And what I did actually, I said, well, I might want to do this, but I went back and instead of actually thinking about how cleverly I could revise all the accepted stuff about the French Revolution, I went back to actually what had been written in the centennial year of the French Revolution, in 1889. And so I kind of communed with something that was and felt very close to those epic 19th century narratives. And I tell that story just out of a sense that I do want to kind of change the subject and shift people's angle of inspection almost. I mean, I think of, you know what I think, and there are certain things I really hate about the formulaic aspects of history books. There must be an introduction, there must be a conclusion. If you're telling stories, you can't possibly have an argument. That was not how it went in the 19th century, and they were cleverer than that in a way. I always think about history, for those other than purely academics, as a kind of enormous window through which you want to kick the reader almost on the first page, so that the rest of their life completely disappears and they are at that moment in Venice, as my book starts on page 3 or 4 in 1523. So I'm just really, I'm omnivorously interested in places where other people haven't particularly gone. I mean, I'll give you one example from belonging. The most famous Jew in 18th century England, really for 150 years almost, happens to be a professional boxer. Not a philosopher, not a scholar, not a rabbi. He's the one who absolutely changes the way Jews and non-Jews think about themselves, because he writes a memoir, and he's the world's first celebrity sportsman. He's like Muhammad Ali. And he embraces his Jewish identity up front as a way to make a splash in late 18th century society. And that's I didn't write a whole chapter about Dan Mendoza in order to overthrow the notion that, you know, Anglo-Jewish history was all about the Rothschilds, for example, and about banks. It just seemed to me the fact of the matter that if you talk to anybody who was not Jewish in Bristol or Leicester, they probably wouldn't have heard of the Rothschilds, but they sure would have heard of Dan Mendoza. So it's a matter of following the trail of the truth.
To your wonderful revisionist through reporting rather than interpretation or ideology.
I'm with you, Colin. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It reminds me when I was in Poland. I don't know if you've been to this museum. There's a new museum in Warsaw, the Museum of the History of the Jews in Poland.
Yeah.
And it was described to me as it's a revisionist Jewish museum because it's not just about the Holocaust. No, what it's about is the 5 million massacres before the Holocaust. You know, so it's kind of still the same spine,
right.
A lot more material. Anyway, other questions? How about right here? Yeah.
I think this is a question that has been asked many times, but based on all the research you've done, what do you think is the secret of the survival of Jewish people?
Well, it's sure not the cooking. the Sephardi cooking is pretty good. Do you know, I think, I mean, again, it's a hard answer and an easy answer. I don't want to make it facetious, but I think actually the genius planted very early was portability. That's to say that, you know, if you think about the great legal prescriptions of the civilizations of the Fertile Crescent, they're inscriptions on buildings, essentially, or enormous statues and what colossal the works of kings and so on. And I'm not saying that if you think about, you know, the Colossi in the Upper Nile Valley at Thebes and Luxor and Karnak and so on, which isn't to say there weren't important papyri, but what was extraordinary, and we don't quite know where that came from, was the notion that the portable scroll, actually, that you would take with you whatever befell you, and memorize it and read it every week. I mean, really, one of the most extraordinary moments in the Bible takes place, and this was almost certainly the book of Nehemiah, so probably written in the 5th century BC during, obviously, the Persian period, but written pretty close to the events it was describing. Ezra claims, there were all sorts of stories about finding mysterious scrolls, a bit Dan Brown, that happens with King Josiah as well. So mysterious scrolls always being found. So these scrolls have been both brought back from Babylon, and certain things have been found and added. But Ezra builds a dais, we're told, and reads the Torah out loud to the people. And he reads it out loud so that the Bible says everyone, and this is men, women, and children as well, not just the men, could understand. In other words, people who are illiterate could understand it as well. So sense of vocal performance and memorization, which you kind of take for granted as the core of Judaism, was something which then liberated, I'm not saying the scribal caste, everything the great scholars like Seth Sanders teach us is that the scribal caste is extraordinarily important, as it was in classical China and Mesopotamia, but it kind of liberates the monopoly of understanding what it means to be Jewish entirely from the hands of a priesthood and a scribal caste. And every so often there's another archaeological discovery which predates the writing of the Bible of ABC, of alphabets written on walls. Sometimes, obviously, the ones that survive are indeed chipped into walls. So it sadly, you know, goes against what I was just saying about portability. But that gives you a sense in which actually the 22-letter linear alphabet, which also exists, of course, in Linear B in Greece, pretty much at the same time, is up and running very early on, and it's internalized in such a way that it can go wherever you go. That has to be part of it. We were talking about this lovely book called Jews and Words, I think, but written by the great novelist Amos Oz and his daughter Fania, and they talk very much in that way, and I share that view. Hey, you know, I'm a wordsmith, so I'm bound to think that, aren't I?
I know you're a historian of Jewish past. I wonder if you'd hazard a guess at Jewish future.
Yeah, I'm always asked this. Well, you know, the fact is that Orthodoxy is great success right now, but it's also very embattled in Israel, less embattled in the United States. There are all sorts of lamentations about the rate of intermarriage. I belong to a Reform synagogue, actually in London, where usually I also belong to a Reform synagogue in my suburb in the Hudson Valley, until the rabbi insisted on bringing out a keyboard and playing it during the New Year services. And when he got to kind of John Denver, that was it, you know. You know, I don't think the Baal Shem Tov would have had much to say to John Denver, or vice versa. So he lost me right then and there. But that's by way of saying I belong to very vibrant Reform communities that are facing the issue of the desertion or the disappearance of youngsters from Judaism and trying to be more expansive. It's very tricky. It's a very tricky thing because on the one hand, you do want to be as open as you possibly can, as inventive, as welcoming. The Reform Synagogue organization which is sort of a bit between conservatism and Reform here, I think, in Britain anyway, quite rightly, has gone back to patrilineal definitions of who is Jewish and who isn't. That's to say, if your father is a Jew, this was the case in the Bible, it was only changed to matrilineal in the Talmud, then you could be considered a Jew as much as if your mother is. So there are really important and welcoming things like that, but the demographics are not so great. And I'm saying the tricky thing is, on the one hand, you want to be as welcoming and expansive, but you know you don't want to have anything to do with John Denver, so nothing against him personally. By which I mean, you know, I think the absolute central core of Midrash, of storytelling, of the Bible, of the Torah, that it ultimately is at the that's the irreducible heart of Judaism, however much you might believe or not believe in God, even, you know. So you really don't want to lose that, I think.
You know that his given name was John Denverwitz.
Denverwitz, yeah. Well,
that's something you're not aware of. I'll tell you about it later.
Boy.
We are out of time.
Because, Carlin, always, you know, they have to have another joke before we go. Don't they? So it's got to involve food somehow, and it's very. I want to leave you with extra appetite. That for some reason there are a lot of jokes about Jews and parrots, really. And so I'll give you the very short one. So a chassid comes into a bar with a parrot on his shoulder, and the bartender says, "That's amazing. Where do you get him?" And the parrot says, "Brooklyn. There are thousands of them."
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.